Okay. So, refreshed and all, we resume this third seminar that is about strategies in crisis and strategies for reputation. And you will understand that reputation actually has a very positive role in many crises because it can help create a halo effect. You still remember, hopefully, the word halo from an earlier seminar in this series. It creates a halo effect. It can enhance trust and it influences the assessment of source credibility. Credibility, a word that we addressed a lot earlier also. But it can also make matters worse. So reputation can erode when a performance evokes very negative emotions, for example, unethical behavior, when the company after the crisis broke, because it's not just what happened before the crisis, but it's also what a company does after a crisis has broken. So is it taking responsibility? Is it having a strong or a weak response? Does it wait until, for example, real bad health matters have happened or people got killed? Or does it act earlier when it gets early signals of warning? How is it communicating? Is it communicating one-sided, as was often the case for Malaysia Airlines, for example, from the organization's perspective? But it could also take expectations into account. So there's two ways to really address what people are thinking about, what you hear in an investigation like yours. So you can begin to work really interactive, which is, of course, very good to do. So when people have comments and problems on social media, to also be there and answer for them. But you can also use what you hear to address those matters in a more general matter. So maybe it's not always the same channel that you choose. Maybe you don't act directly, but indirectly you can also use what you hear to address what people have concerns about. This is an example of how you can actually make matters worse. And bad advertising just after the crisis. Malaysia Airlines apologizes for the bucket list promotional campaign. A bucket list is a list what you would like still to do before you're dead. It's really not a suitable topic to discuss here. And after that, of course, Malaysia Airlines apologized for starting a promotional campaign. A promotional campaign after such an event that asked customers to name their bucket list for travel destinations. Many criticized the idea of actually talking about the bucket list because of the airline's connections to the two earlier tragedies. The link you can also open at the moment. We don't have the time to do that. But a quick question to you could be, how can such things actually happen? How is it possible that there is a marketing campaign using the word bucket list, something you do before you die, something you really want to do before that, in this case? So how is it possible? Where do you see is this mistake made? Could you spontaneously maybe react to that? How can it happen?
What do you think? Sorry. What's your opinion on the matter?
Because you might say, this is so stupid that this shouldn't happen, so why does it happen? And of course, opposite where you are, but a little bit higher on your side also, there are some ideas.
I don't know how it really happened, but I think it must be a quite big organization, so maybe inside the organization they didn't know what the other team or marketing team was doing, so maybe it was the lack of communication.
And I suppose in big organizations, they plan ahead their campaigns. So this was planned several months ago. So then they just started it even though they had a big crisis ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Where was your idea in along same lines and behind you too? Yeah. Okay. So some of you may know the term integrated communication, which assumes not only that, I mean, it works both ways between marketing and corporate communication, that it's, of course, integrated, not only integrated marketing that we need, but we also need integrated communication in a firm, that everybody thinks with such matters in mind in both functional areas that is presumed. So the marketing department should be involved enough, should be organized in the organogram, in the structure of the company, close enough to the corporate communication department to have affinity with what is happening. They should not be left aside when you're tackling with such a major disaster. And the same, of course, the other way around. The corporate communication department should also have an interest in the kind of campaigns that are long-term organized by the marketing department. And so they should, in that sense, have been taken care of by what we call integrated communication. If you didn't do that course, you can find a book with that title on my name, and then I hope you will be interested in marketing communication and corporate communication and how we can really improve such matters. So the book is called Integrated Communication. It's in the library. Okay, so that explains, and unfortunately, so almost when there is a crisis, more things go wrong. So you could almost wait for such a thing. So you might even, if you're head of corporate communications, you might even start checking, just preventively. A crisis is a series of issues. And how can you make strategies for communication if you don't know what issues the crisis is composed of? So the best suggestion that we can give to people in practice is to find out the pattern. So to look in your monitoring results for a pattern that explains to you which different peaks are visible. So look for different topics that may still be low in attention but may grow. And don't think that there is one crisis peak. But think about a crisis as an umbrella for different issues. And there might be things underwater that will, like an iceberg, become above of the water visible when you are a bit further on in time. So only that idea is already helping to identify these different topics in online communication. And if you're interested in this, this is about social, all kinds of social media, not only Facebook. There's a dissertation of Boyang Zhang, and there are also publications by him and joined by me, but it was supported by Jari Veerlijnen, an IT professor. So, recommended. It's a dissertation of June. Risk perception. So people tend to fear hazards less when they gain more knowledge about risks. So very often companies and also authorities, they think we'd better not tell them because it might make them more afraid. Actually, what is making you really nervous is that you don't understand a thing about it. So it's usually opposite. Knowledge is not making it worse. Knowledge is usually decreasing the feeling of utter powerlessness and lack of information that people feel. Of course, a crisis is such an extreme event that in the beginning we very often don't know much. So it takes a couple of days often until we really understand what has happened. And in that period there will be board members not understanding that you still need to communicate. So you need to communicate about what you know, which may be an incomplete picture, but if you give them what you know, you gain that all-important credibility that you have been addressing so much in earlier meetings. And also, there might be people who fill in all kinds of knowledge gaps And maybe you should explicitly address what you do not know yet. But there is no reason to yet think, because so people might be a little paranoid and fill in. So if they don't know what's happening, and if you don't tell them that it, you don't know yet if this is a case of terrorism or not, then they will definitely start to think it is, and will make things worse in their feelings. So they are often more afraid of things easily imagined or that they hear about repeatedly. So what is repeated a lot in the news. Yeah?
It's the same case when a president, you know, when a natural disaster happens or when a president comes out and reassures the people that everything is going to be safe, even though nothing has been happening. The overall rate of calm will always be there.
Okay, so if the president, you said, comes out after a disaster to tell that everything is done about it,
yeah, I mean,
but that is not the case, that you actually create insecureness among the public.
You
cause the insecurity.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. That's a very good example. So people believe very often that their knowledge is correct. So many, there's not many people that doubt so much. Not maybe when you are here in a university, our main effect is that you start to doubt if what you know really is true. And actually, that could be one of the major benefits of doing an academic study. But normally people believe that they know more than they do, and they have a lot of opinions even though they lack the information around it. So it is very important to contribute to awareness of risks and to information about risks. Of course, this is also interculturally different, because there are countries where for every place in the country there is a risk map. For example, the Netherlands has that. So if you live in a certain area, you can look up what level of risk and what type of risk there are exactly in that place. The Germans don't like to do that, because they think it raises an uncertainty feeling. So they don't communicate about it. So there's a big difference between two countries that are close to one another, but still in some aspects have very different opinions in how authorities go about their business. So, but I think that there is this fact, and there is a source underneath. You cannot read it here, but if you want the source, you can take it from your slides. So what can an organization do, and what can you contribute to if you can convince that organization that it needs to arrange these matters? So, of course, very important to think of crisis preparedness, and I will explain that better in a next slide. So how to be prepared for something that might happen, to have scenarios, to have possible responses, etc. It's also important to have already in line monitoring, to be able to deal with uncertainties so that you know which uncertainties exist. Actually, you don't need to wait for a crisis to happen to start your monitoring, so you should have it online. There are companies that already have what they call a war room, and I think that is really exaggerated, as if it is in the dark corners of the building, a war room, where they then bring together all the information on the crisis and what people think and what they should do. And, of course, there is a real crisis room below, for example, the Prime Minister's office, where they have it set up with all kinds of screens where information can be brought together, where phones can be taken by many people, where websites have a better... many people will go to the website, and you must, of course, ensure that the website can handle that, that it doesn't go down, because many people will go there. Of course, it's also part of preparedness that you could have such sites already, and that they don't need to be dark, but that they actually are there always to help people with preparedness. So they could have tips for preparedness when there is no problem, and they could have crisis information, and that could even be a national website, but it could also be arranged in a kind of network format. It takes special skills to put information on crisis websites. Maybe in my country this is a bit exaggerated, but there are about 32 different trainings for different kinds of skills and different kind of roles during crises. And this is alone for authorities. So I'm not even talking about other types of organizations, like infrastructure organizations. So responding to the crisis means that you first look at decreasing any harm. So that means corrective action. So what can we do to actually immediately decrease harm? Increase also people's ability to cope with what is going on. So give people instructions that they should not eat, for example, the food from their garden because it may be polluted, so clear lines. All such messages could be pre-prepared and follow templates for different situations. And they could be tested because it's true that it's quite difficult to give clear instructions so that really this is helpful. And, of course, there are all kinds of responses possible, from denial to no, there was no emission problem in the Volkswagen car. Well, they did not do that, of course. To shifting the blame, like actually somebody else might be to blame, or often also not a wise thing to do. Apple should, of course, never say, it's not my problem, it's the problem of Foxconn. No, you should not do that, because people will blame you for that. And apologies are called apologia, but it's apologies theory, and there's a lot of work of scholars done about how and why and in which situations. I will return to that in a moment. So, and when you're not responding anymore, but you're really resolving the crisis, it's all about responsibility and accountability. Accountability, taking responsibility, and being willing to report how you are doing it and also why, but being open about how the crisis is tackled, what Ferrero Rocher is doing to prevent new worms from appearing in your nice chocolates. And of course we have access to information that is important, transparency, ethics of humanistic care play a role, and learning from the crisis for future crisis. Actually, the public is not always so interested to learn from one crisis to the next, because many people are already very happy after the hurricane that it's built up again. So learning is not the most popular thing to do, because people want to leave it behind them. They are still emotionally so highly involved in the crisis that it's very difficult for them to start thinking about future matters, because they would actually like not to hear about it at all. So also for companies it's quite difficult, and sometimes even emotionally difficult, to try to learn from such a crisis, which is why we talk about the golden hour of information, meaning really fast after things have happened. There is this golden hour still also of learning that you should use, not too late. And also organizations should learn from crises that are not theirs, but other organizations in the same sector. Because then there is not such a hindrance to learning in such situations, because it's a competitor that had that problem. And then you can start to address, but how are we doing that in this instance? What would we have done? And then you can really seize the opportunity for learning. What is crisis preparedness? I mentioned it a moment ago. It's questions like this. Is there really a crisis management procedure for all kinds of matters? And does it include communication enough? Or is there something about recalls, but communication is not addressed enough? Is it also tested? Does it include personnel? Is personnel trained to talk on the phone? Because at the moment that there has been a crisis, people are asked to fill in phone services that usually don't do them. So you're drawing on a bigger group. Has that group had any trainings? Does the organization have a clear view of what are actually threats, looking at this field of forces? You can think about that. And of course, does it know the stakeholders well enough and the communication habits? So the idea is not that we communicate through channels that we have, company channels only, and that people will start to have go looking for them. No, what people will do is, well, like any of us do, we search maybe, we Google, and what we find should really have that information. So if we are talking about it on Facebook, the company has to be on Facebook. So there's no choice there. You have to be everywhere where people are looking for you and where people need it. Because otherwise they will talk over your head and you will not be part of the conversation. And you are the one with a lot of information, with also the responsibility to be there. So we always use this multi-channel approach so that we are basically everywhere where it is needed. And there are all kinds of tools that facilitate that maybe similar messages can be put out via different social media channels. Does it follow issues? Does it act to reduce? Okay, it's quite obvious. During a crisis, people may in social media discuss what happened, and they may do that to understand the event. So sometimes people are not even involved themselves, but they were hearing about Fukushima, for example, and they just want to make sense of it. What has happened there? And of course they also wonder what happened there. Does it also relate to other nuclear reactors? Or is it something specific that happened in Fukushima? Yes, there were a lot of was a lot of trouble with that particular reactor complex. And also the tsunami was much higher than it was estimated to be. But still, the main problem, I think, was also that all over the world, talking with nuclear companies, everybody knew that the company involved, TEPCO, had major problems in its management. So really that also, and this was a reactor that was supposed to close not so long later. So it was known that it was a risky matter. Maybe not that risky, but. So people may in social media just want to find out how did it happen. So they want to form themselves an opinion about it. They may also go to social media to express support for those affected by it. So there's a lot of very positive messaging, especially Facebook channels are used a lot for that purpose, whereas to get the news right is seen, for example, a little bit more on Twitter. And countries that have frequently risks and crises occurring, in those countries, Twitter is used much more, whereas here a lot of people can't imagine that they would use Twitter for such purposes. Well, it's very practical in the case of an emergency, and countries where that happens frequently automatically grab for it. Promote own interests. That's also what's happening in crises, but also own emotions, own worries. So it's known that people can express their feelings relatively well in social media. So it is also a platform that helps express and somehow exchange and address. In that sense, it might even help to heal some people a little bit. And it is, of course, used to discuss views on organizations that are involved and other actors involved, where the most strange stories might go around that may not be true at all, but also stories that really are closer to truth. But the question is, why would you monitor and what would you do it for? Because this was what people may discuss in social media. But why do you need to, what do you want to learn from monitoring? What is it for? Could we get some quick results? Maybe immediately.
Who wants to go?
Yeah, or talk with your neighbor and we will immediately get in. Yeah? So, what do you want to learn from monitoring?
Okay, let's continue. So I came to this group. So what are your ideas on what's monitoring used for, or what, how would you like to use it during a crisis?
Well, at least if there are some rumors that are not like at all accurate, you can kind of stay in control and kind of like, even if you're not, you're, well, in a way you're in control and you can say, wait a minute, at least this didn't happen, it was like this. So that's what we were discussing now.
You need to know the rumors, but to stay in control, is that possible at all anyhow?
Well, I don't even know. But if people are starting to discuss it, kind of like just, I don't know. Well, yeah.
I think that's a good answer. Because you never know, and it's not, maybe not in all. But still, it's important to know about these rumors. Yeah. Knowing, even though you know you can't, you can never fully do that. You okay?
Other I think there answers? Was another comment.
Oh, here. So probably possible questions and needs of the customers.
Yeah, needs could be needs that relate to physical actions, but it could also be information needs that people have. Is my car involved in the case of Volkswagen? That was probably the only thing they actually started telling, but yeah. Great. Yeah, that does pose the question, can you always first monitor and then communicate? Because I should tell you simply that next Friday we have a dissertation about terrorism cases of Aino, our colleague, and she tells it actually that all happens at the same time. So at the same time that you are already communicating because you cannot stop doing, you immediately have to do that. In the case of the school shootings, for example, we also investigated those. Within an hour in one of the cases, there was already one of the people involved tweeting about it. So the company cannot first monitor. Well, if you need that, that information, that tweet to know what's going on, I hope it's faster, but at least that you can use. So she draws it like a yin and yang sign, or like two arrows that go into one another, where you on the one hand are all the time monitoring, and on the other hand you're all the time also with your hands in it doing the communication itself. So it doesn't only help to be prepared for the communication, but it also helps to see what it does. So if you have communicated something about an evacuation, and you should then also see, but if you, of course, some of the other managers will see what is actually happening, but you hear and see people talk about it, so are they really doing the evacuations, or are many people discussing, I don't want to leave my house, for example, or I have no transportation. So it is not only to be prepared for your communications, but also to see what the effect is of what you're doing. Because otherwise you're like blind. You are doing something, but you don't know what the result of that is, if there is any result of it. So in order, so what you say is exactly right, but it's even more so. You also need to see what are the consequences of what you are doing, because otherwise you are like blind. Yeah. Okay. This case comes also with a question. Nokia case in Bochum, you must have heard about it. It's now already some years ago. But what you must take into account before I can ask my question is that in a German region that had high unemployment, 10 years, less than 10 years before Nokia withdrew there, they got subsidies to build a plant there so that there would be more employment. And these subsidies are, of course, important in the story, because in less than 10 years, they stopped their activities in Bochum. This was before the problems also became visible in Finland. You should also know that the unions are very strong. Well, in Finland maybe also, but I think much more active and political active in Germany. You can see that actually in many cases, because even the company Benetton, there were some actions against it at the moment that it had nice advertising, but actually their activities were not as nice as they said in their advertising. Not so colorful, not so etc. And then it were the German customers that went into the stores and threw the clothes on the floor. So, and in other countries they were just having a sign up there. But so there are pretty active people there, and the unions are also very, very strong in Germany. At the moment they had no deficit, so they were making a profit in their Bochum plant. So they were not making a deficit there. But Romania was simply cheaper. And later, by the way, Romania was left also. And then they started to also have lots of Finnish jobs that came later when it was already quite clear that they were in trouble. So what's the question? Well, you can still look at the pictures where it says Nokia not connecting, but something else, deleting people. And there you have connecting people in, making it quite ridiculous what is happening there, almost like carnival. If you want to read, by the way, about crisis in Finnish, these two pictures I received from my predecessor, Professor Emeritus Lehtonen, and he wrote about it in Finnish, and it's of course some years ago, but it might still be nice for some of you to check his Julkisuudet riskit. I have been trying to do that, but I was not very successful, but of course he also has some English. So the question is, looking at the crisis at Bochum, what can communication do, and maybe what can't it? Because this case, would it have helped? Or so you understand my question. These people were fired, okay? So what can communication do in such a case, and maybe also what it can't do? And maybe you can also philosophize a bit about the kind of impact that such a crisis then has on public perceptions, or which stakeholders, or so what effect did it have, what happened in Bochum? I took Bochum and not Finland, because you know much better how it went in Finland. Of course, I was there all of the time. But this is a safe area, and maybe it is more objective if you look at the German case. There might be some Germans here. Do we have them? No? No. Ah, okay. Well, let's keep that in mind. But you just go ahead. What kind of impact did it have, and what can communication, or what can't it? Can it really not do? Discuss it. Yeah, take a time. Could be.
Any way you communicate it, it's still going to backlash in the
power. Could be.
Because, you know, it's actually going to create more problems than this.
I got it.
Maybe not. Yeah, you can also begin with that.
Okay. Okay, let's start the discussion. I noticed that there was something interesting going on over here, so could you please share your thoughts on the topic? Who wants to take the mic?
We were just thinking that, I mean, does it help if the company explains, like, these are the big trends and the economy, like the mega trends, that that we have to find some cheaper places, and it's not only, like, because they are bad, but it's just how they can... they can be successful in the market because there's a lot of competition. So this they can kind of try to explain, but and people can in a way understand this, but I don't know if it helps, if it touches you personally.
Yeah, that would be, for example, the fact that even though you are still, but for how long, you are still profitable, you will not win the international competition by just being profitable. Mm. So you need to be one of the top three brands.
Yeah.
And otherwise, you're a goner. But the question is also, with whom should they then have communicated? Because when I looked at the reaction of the unions, I got the feel that they were hardly included in any information, so that the deepness of the negotiations with the unions had also been grasped later. Because maybe of intercultural differences between the countries, maybe the role that normally the unions have in they cannot prevent closure, but they could have some kind of role in the process of closing, perhaps. Of course, this would always have been a bad case, because firing people is always bad. Yeah. In the news, yeah, well, let's go to another reaction. Thank you. Just wait a while, because now it doesn't take long.
Or maybe try and get one of those union, you know, top position people to actually talk. I mean, talk to them and make people calm. I mean, tell them smoothly, rather than, you know, like rushing into things. Like tell them that, okay, you know what, we know that this is happening, but they have no other option, and they have to do it in order to like save the company.
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I think you should not be too optimistic about the unions. You would like to keep members also, so the unions will not let themselves be used as for the communication or scapegoats for the company. But exactly such matters and roles you could also be prepared for. There were newspaper stories of people that just got working there a month earlier and then again lost a job, or people of which more than one family member recently had started working for the company and now the whole family lost their jobs, for example. So such stories in a way told that there had not been much foresight involved, because why still attract people? Of course, there was a question that you had that we should also address about when can you start informing people. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, we were just discussing that in this case. So would it have helped if they would have informed the employees beforehand, going public about it? But then we were thinking that how would it affect then? Is it more negative effects, or and would the company like to give out that information, because then it affects the prices of shares, and that's kind of perhaps vital for their strategy and so. But we were debating.
Yes, and that was a very good point. Because there are legal obligations that a company has towards its shareholders. So financial relations should never hear later than anybody else, and they should all hear at the same time. So that is why the moment when you go public, you have to organize a lot. But of course, companies will usually go to a lot of trouble, and I think probably they did that too, meaning that you should have people on ground floor, at the ground floor everywhere, for oral information, that at the moment that it goes public, there could be, for example, not press releases, but inside information bulletins handed out to people that go home or that enter the workplace, whatever is at that moment. So you plan to have it. It's almost like a sad campaign. That at that moment it bursts and you are ready everywhere to, because you cannot tell the employees before the shareholders, because then some will have the advantage, will start sell or will start buy, etc. So or options or. So you have to do everything at the same time, so you have to be really ready. That's one thing that you can do. But what you cannot do is, of course, to prevent the firing of people. That you cannot do. But earlier than this happened, maybe there could have been less new jobs created. But of course, that has to do with how this is organized. Very often it's difficult for communication departments to advise well in such situations. I understand that because the communication department could also be fired, so they are part of the matters that happen. On the other hand, I hear also stories from Finland where communication people inside have been able to reduce a lot of bad feelings among personnel just by at least arranging matters more clearly and not, let's say, one day before Christmas or other standard methods that are sometimes taken. Okay, any more things? What kind of impact did it have? It did have a lot of impact on a lot of different kinds of stakeholders. And also other places where Nokia was active around the globe. So this was a loud crisis for them. Well, okay, I leave you ponder about that. Of course, this is part of a bigger discussion also. Employment and the way in which we see employment. Is employment a means that also helps equality in society, that everybody should have something like a right to be employed? Some people used to think about that. Nowadays we have robotics, and robotics may change the number of employment for people. So maybe the whole structure of the economy and the mechanisms that we use for example, equality or not to get too big differences in income in society and therefore becoming a very unstable society, all those things are going to change probably, and we haven't all the solutions for them. Yeah? You have to wait a little while because this sounds interesting.
Thank you, sorry. I make you walk around. So basically, Bill Gates was proposing a new solution where these robots are taxed like a normal human being and where people would start to get like a universal basic income, where I think Finland is the first country actually trialing it out, when the machine domination actually takes place.
Yeah, so if maybe smaller groups earn more financial benefits, you can also do it a little bit different than he suggested. So why are then these smaller groups having all those benefits? And let's stick with Bill Gates in this case. Who am I to come up with a different solution? Yeah. Well, you can also Google it around because there's many different ideas about changes that are needed. I was promising to tell you a little bit more about apologia theory, which belongs to what is called situational crisis communication theory of Timothy Combs. And it's situational because it assumes that depending on the situation, it is more or less expected that you come with an apology strategy, which could still render some credibility to your organization. Of course, this relates mainly to issues, reputation issues, because if there are real crises, for example, pollution, problems in the production, of course, in those cases, you need to do more than just apologize, because then you really need to change your production
etc. So that's different. But there is a lot of theory about only this issue side of it and the public and the policy issues that occur. So public attribution then, according to this theory, should decide what you should do. So if the organization is seen as a victim, you take that as a starting point for your communications. If the organization, if you do monitoring, is seen as the cause of the trouble, you need to act very differently. And then, of course, apologies are more appropriate. So the question is, was the organizational behavior lacking? That can be one reason for the trouble, but another way to put it is maybe you weren't the reason, but maybe you could have prevented it anyway by having certain procedures and mechanisms in place. And if that is the case, taking appropriate responsibility, apologies, and commitment to change policy making in the future or production in the future is, of course, appropriate to do. And proactive. So the company can be proactive, meaning that you are fast giving transparency about what happened, taking responsibility. And one of these examples is even called stealing thunder. And stealing thunder in the literature of communication means that you tell what was wrong there before others do so. So you steal the thunder by being open yourself. And of course, this word already looks a little bit manipulative. So it can also mean that you are already starting to talk about it in the middle of the summer or when there is something else going on, like Olympics. So that would mean that sometimes companies choose the moment so that there is a bit less attention, and then it is in a way cheap to be able to tell about that problem that you had, whereas actually you were honest, but the moment is a bit, well, cheap. It's not bad, but it's cheap. So that is called stealing thunder. And then there is something about image repair. So a company can go for image repair, treating it like an issue, like a policy matter, that you can maybe amend by talking, talk the talk. Or it can go for organizational renewal, because something may have been seriously wrong in the production of Ferrero Rocher, and maybe there really need to be more checks for the quality involved. And in that case, we say it should walk the walk rather than just talk the talk. So image repair, talk the talk, or organizational renewal, walk the walk. So what are we doing? Reducing damage, recalls, offering compensation, or actually change policies. My question to you is, can you apply these points that I have now talked about, that are above on this slide? And how was that in the Volkswagen case? And how would you then reflect on the Volkswagen case? There's two groups focusing on it, but it's too interesting not to use it also for the others here. So if you look at the Volkswagen case, organization as victim or cause, and you go by these bullets, what is then your analysis? And Jenny, could you look around? But please start talking, because this was about buzzing.
Okay. Let's continue. In this group, you seem to have some strong opinions about the matter. Would you like to share your ideas with the others?
Well, we thought that in the case of Volkswagen, they shouldn't have done anything. Okay, that sounds wrong. Sorry, my brain is freezing. They shouldn't have had the problem to begin with, because that's such a bad and like severe crisis that you can't really help it. You're just gonna have to like gather the fallen pieces and try to apologize as soon as possible and implement the strategy for like getting the cars back to the factories and like fixing the problems. So there's nothing really.
This was our problem. Good.
Thank you.
Other views? Yeah, can't say anything against it. Was wise. Yeah. More?
Any other groups? No. Maybe we just continue then. I think they're getting tired.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely not, because no, this is too important. So they were not a victim, but that it was all implicit in your answer. They were the cause, so they should just bleed. Or, well, if I put it a bit stronger than you did, forgive me. What did they do? Did they give apologies? What did they do? Did it? You feel? Yeah. Yeah, there was some denial in early stages. Actually, they knew earlier of it than we did. So earlier than that American authority put it in the open, at least a month earlier, but probably even more early, they knew about the problem and they did not bring it out. Maybe because it would have severe effects for them. So they did not choose stealing thunder. They did not... Actually, they did nothing, actually, at that stage. That is a bit strange, because there could have been matters prepared in that meantime. But I think they were also really not counting on this to happen, or an internal denial of that it was really happening now could have happened. There was a big board discussion between PH and the current CEO. In that case. So something has been happening in the background on the board level, and different policies, they did not agree on the policies here. And that was all probably around that moment. So it was not proactive, they did not, but after a while it became almost impossible to not go to apologies. And then they gave apologies, as you correctly informed us. What about their commitment? Did they show large commitment or small commitment? So they followed the legal obligations. I'll tell because you're not having the mic there. So they followed the legal obligations that were strong in the United States, and there they did what they should do, and in Europe there were lower demands. Yeah, so they followed legal procedures and they didn't do much extra, you could say. So the compensations offered were following, and actually there are a lot of court cases still going on. So that's not a proactive way to act. It's not even sure that that would be advisable in that case, because as the first answer was, it is such a severe case already. So how do you feel about that? So is it image repair strategy or organizational renewal strategy that was followed? Somebody just told me, was that before the break or at the beginning of the break, it was amazing that the shares were already going up. That was one of the groups that focuses on it. So shares were not doing too bad. Well, they were losing, of course. Yeah.
Maybe if they only did what they kind of had to do legally, then it's maybe more image repair. I don't know what kind of organizational changes they actually did.
There was a new CEO that started to talk about electric vehicles. So not making diesel cars, well, he didn't say not making them anymore, but talking about going more into the direction of electric vehicles, which is now something that all the car brands do for various reasons. Okay, so I think this helps assess what a company is doing. We could go much deeper than this, but I think for our purposes that is okay. But I wanted, of course... that is actually not... Where did I keep it? I thought there was something else behind this. Apologia. Yeah, I thought there was a question, but I'm going to ask it anyhow. And First Ideas own case. Is there something that you can recommend your organization? And we had a... Oh, for Bochum, I forgot you. But Volkswagen is German too. Yeah, let's ask if you have an opinion on the Volkswagen case that might be adding to what we heard, because in Germany you hear different stories. Please give the phone... microphone. Yeah.
Actually, it's quite larger than just Volkswagen, but also Audi and Porsche is involved in it. I mean,
Audi is of course owned by Volkswagen.
Yeah, also Porsche.
And Porsche is also owned.
They all belong to Volkswagen, but at first they were just like all people thought it would be just Volkswagen because it's not completely combined the company, but it's. They have different factory sites and different
brands,
models,
yeah.
And everything. So it's just like they own it, but in the end it came out that everything or every company, every part of the company had actually faked the results or had the problems or did the same than Volkswagen. And also the other ones like BMW or Daimler had also, they are not belonging to Volkswagen, but they have also the software used or similar software used.
Yeah, or different ways, but anyhow, the test results are not presenting an emissions that is so high as it's actually on the road. Yeah, and those responsible for testing in Europe, it is so that that is organized via the producers of the cars, which is a different situation than we have in the United States. Did you hear, because there was a software adaptation needed for these cars, how people are reacting to that software adaptation in Germany?
Actually, I think that...
there was a recall, yeah?
Yeah, but I actually think that, in my personal opinion, that the outcry, public outcry wasn't that big as it could have been, because like there are a lot of... cars with a diesel motor in Germany use. It's really common there. But, I mean, in the things the company has to pay, or there weren't even real fines, but they just have to, like, put back the cars and to change the software to make an update. But, it was the fine was lower than, for example, in the USA. But the people weren't that outraged for it as I could have expected it.
Well, in the Netherlands, I could see a German documentary on Dutch television where they explained that actually the update of the software did not improve the car emission. Hardly or not at all in some cases, so it actually didn't do much. But they got the permission to do it this way from political entities, also in European Union. So it seems that the car industry is so important for employment in Europe that this was all that was done, or almost all that could be done.
Yeah, I think so too, because, for example, I was at the Audi, at the main place where Audi is. It's a smaller city, northern of Munich, and there, like, nearly everyone who lives there works at Audi, or maybe another combined company that works with Audi. So it's really important for the local regions, but also totally for Germany as a total country, because it gives so many jobs.
But it could be that there still is a new crisis upcoming about new events, because now it seems, I don't know how much it helps that there were new elections in Germany, but now it seems that the stance of the German government of Merkel has changed in this opinion, and that maybe there will be some compensation for owners of cars, because they bought something what actually was something different than they thought they were buying. So the information on the car was not correct. And now they're asked to bring in their car to let it be amended, and actually what it does is nothing. And there are sometimes more trouble than with the car than without going to the recall. So there are some lobbyists in Brussels that think that recalls should be obligatory to get. That if you have a product that's not okay and then there's a recall, you should actually be obliged to go there and get that recall. Because, that is being discussed now. But in this case, the recall itself became a new little crisis, because people were so angry that they had to come back with the car. Well, you also cannot do that. I'm not doing that. Because I heard that it might it's not working, actually, that it's a fake matter. So if that's true or not, there's a lot of rumors again. So that's why a crisis has a combination of peaks, and there's all the time new reasons, and your rumors that you addressed are then popping up again, but about new matters. So the last page of this story has not yet been talked about. Question is all the time, if you would have a more proactive strategy, would it have been better? Of course, the whole question has already been decided very long ago in the past, where somewhere it was decided that the market in America should be conquered, and they're using the slogan green diesel, clean diesel. So, and in that at that moment, actually, the best communication advice might have been given, but you'd have to be pretty high up in the hierarchy of the company to not then be fired when there is this big fight already going on between board members like Piek and at the moment, the current CEO. So this is a matter that is a bit rough to get into, so maybe not so feasible. But the cause lies long ago, and maybe it's now a question of bleeding. But the question is also, are there other elements in the reputation that still give Volkswagen a good chance to survive this, if their quality of their products is really rated so high that this is only one of the elements of the reputation that they have problems for? Does it work like that? So it's very difficult to predict if an upcoming crisis will really work like a halo that is then dominating the whole reputation of the organization, or that reputation is somehow so strong. Also look at the case of Apple, that even though there is an issue with Foxconn, that still it survives that issue because its original positioning was so strong. And maybe it is worse for Apple that they haven't got Steve Jobs around than the fact that they had this major problem with Foxconn, which, by the way, is a very large company in China that has more than 13 million people working for it. And they don't only work for Apple, but they also work for many other companies. And actually there we have a problem that could be addressed either by almost leaving the country or maybe thinking about robotics, actually. So there are very different solutions possible, and I don't know what is feasible. So until now, we talked mainly about the book Communication in Turbulent Times. And in chapter 7, you can find more detailed information about strategies and what you actually can choose. It's quite a complicated story to tell in a meeting, so I think it is better to read about it in chapter 7. And I would like to also that relate to this from the other book, monitoring book. So what can organizations actually do? And what organizations can do, I put in three different parts. And the book at the end gives three models that sometimes students find difficult. On the other hand, there are also sometimes students that very cleverly use one of these three models to argue, and you could use a joker card in your report to maybe use one of the three. Who knows? You might be one of those that sees something in it. So at the end of the book, there is a tool actually consisting of three analysis models. Consultants very often need more than just skills like writing skills, presentation skills. No, they need analysis models to find out, to diagnose the situation in a company. And also when you're an internal consultant, you need to form an opinion. You can use audits, and you can also use such models to kind of make sense of what may seem a quite complex picture when you enter an organization as a consultant. So one of the models is about strategic policy. It's split up to make it more simple, because otherwise you get everything in one basket. Strategic policy about clear positioning that is needed. And it depends on the problem at hand, if it can be helped or if it can be characterized more of a profiling problem in the first group, or that it is a problem that relates to organizational policies and preconditions. So are they going through the motions in the right way? Is there research done? There is a third model that is about phasing. Are the steps taken in a logical order? I will go a bit deeper and first begin with the policy directions or the positioning strategies. Similar to brands, also companies need clear positioning strategies. Because if they are not clear, of course, you can also... A clear positioning is more important even than a good positioning, as long as it is clear. So you can have three groups of positioning strategies there. So you can alter the relative importance of characteristics, for example, emphasizing, it says here, sportiveness. So one of the characteristics is then emphasized in order to make a clearer picture and to claim a certain positioning in the market for the organization as such. For example, Unilever, we talked about it in a previous class, currently has a very responsible profiling as a company. So that is a choice that you make. And of course, it should then be clear, not only in all your communications, that you constantly try to enhance that idea and prove that idea with examples of star products, of policies, that you are really delivering on that score. So once you decide to go for this type of profiling, emphasizing something, you also should be able to really deliver. That means that you also already are doing it. So it cannot be a desired identity. It has to be already there so that you can deliver it in a very strong can tell. Because you know that only the top three of brands can survive. So you have to be really strong there. So this is taking one of the characteristics that is more important. Because why would you pick out one particular? Well, of course, because there are preferences of your stakeholder groups in that area, or because shareholders find some elements really important nowadays, or it's important to attract the best employees ever, because you don't want them all, but you want the best ones. So for all these reasons, you can choose to emphasize more on one particular characteristic to make it clearer than to tell the whole complex story, but you're focusing more on that because you think that is now, because of the field of forces, some people were showing me their field of forces in the break, it is more important to do that than another characteristic. So that is why it also changes over time, the emphasis that is put on certain positioning strategies. You can also add a new relevant characteristic. And that could be that you start to talk more about electric cars. And maybe at the time it was new to start to talk about clean diesel, but it wasn't really true. So maybe there it was a very high risk positioning that was chosen longer ago to profile yourself on the point that actually was going to be the major risk and that is now also proven to be a major risk everywhere. So change the perception of a characteristic, that is a third possibility, that you talk about electric cars anyhow and that people first think that that is expensive and that then you're repositioning that as affordable. Or perhaps it is seen as something for environmental idiots and you want to show that there are so many points already where you can, or that the number of miles that you can drive with it is already so practical that now it is important for all. Or same for newer fuels, hydrogen car, for example, that it already has many places where you can tank. So then it becomes from exceptional, more you place it more like ordinary. So these are three things, and I would like to give some examples. So this is an example of stressing what many airline companies do. The number of centimeters that you'd have for your business passengers. It's not original, so it is not distinguishing you from others because they're all talking about a few centimeters more and actually it's mainly about leg space and not so much that you can move your arms, which I never understand. But, of course, that is also an expensive solution. So not very distinguishable. So these are choices that have to be made. Will you go for which kind of positioning? Finnair has this different strategy, and this is something they have been doing for years and years already, and it is only now proving its significance, because you know that Helsinki Airport is all the time expanding, and it relates mainly to the transit passengers. But transit passengers bring in economy too, so it's not only those that step out and are going to see your lakes and trees and cities and art. So this is was a very original one, and for years, well, they are still the only one that uses similar positioning. So that is adding a new, at that time, it was adding a new characteristic. And nobody was talking about that. They were all talking about these centimeters. Or some were talking about price. So that was the first model. Actually, it wasn't the model itself. The model itself tells how you can have a very clear line from company policies to how you also communicate that, how your campaigns are, and how from day to day your communication is also led by these clear choices made. And if that vertical line, and also, of course, the advice, and it goes up and down, the other way around, it goes down and up. So that is the first model. You can see it in the book. I'm not showing it to you because at first glance it looks difficult, but actually it's about consistency in organizational policies. That it really, because if people tell you, well, your communication plan, we had it somewhere. Where is it? And they start to open drawers and you think, where was it? No, it should be relevant in your daily activities. What you do and what you don't is led by it. Yeah. So if a company goes for innovativeness, it should be clear that, that when you put out, when you talk about star products, these are always that kind of. So you pick out the examples that really, and maybe you get even more for that, and your internal strategy support it, and you have an internal innovation strategy. So a second model has to do with organizational policy and preconditions taken, and that relates to, so it depends on the consultant where you feel that it, which type of problem is more relevant for the organization. And here there is still a choice of four matters that could be a big problem. The S of systematics is the first one that I want to talk about. And a good example for systematics, so preconditions, the way in which you're working with your communications, is Coca-Cola, but also I think McDonald's, where they go through the motions, they measure a lot, they try to find local adaptations, they measure again, so they do actually all the steps. That doesn't prevent crisis from happening, but in this element they are doing a good job. And then when I go to transition, it means that you're really adaptable, that you're really looking around what should we change, and that you are an agile company in your positioning and in what you do. And for that, I mentioned earlier already, and I'll stick to that because otherwise I'm adding too much complexity, that IBM was known in the past as having that lazy cat mentality, whereas now they have greatly changed. But in the past, there were all these cartoon-like jokes about them, that everybody that entered should be the same gray suit, and they would sit in rooms that, depending on the level of salary and rank, had either a plant or... yeah. So really not appreciating diversity. But that has changed, of course, after crisis, renewal happens, and now they are known for trying to get more diversity in their organization because society is diverse. We don't know what's happening. And if inside you have only, let's say, one type of white, gray, suit-like employee, it becomes really difficult to react appropriately at very different matters that, that happen in society. So you're not flexible enough. Maybe you can quickly decide, because you're all maybe having the same kind of style. Maybe you all came from Harvard or something like that. Also happens often. But it doesn't make you flexible. And this I of integration stands for how well communication is embedded as a function in the organization as a whole. And for that, we already had before this crisis as a bad example, on the list, I'm not lying, this was already there, Volkswagen. So are people, is there integrated communication? Is everybody in that company drenched in the thought of the importance of stakeholder communications, of etc.? It was a negative example. And for example, Siemens was always thought of as a much better example in that case, where the top also understood communication matters very well. And the P stands for policy making. So are there clear profiling choices, and is it also easy to make these decisions because there is some kind of decision power? To give you an example, a good example of that is Heineken. It's a family business, like many other family organizations. They find it a little bit easier often to really decide and go for it. Whereas, for example, a university like this has so many different faculties and faculties have parts, and actually everybody would like to be alone and not together with all these not go in the same direction. So then it becomes really difficult, and I also think about authorities in a similar way. They have a very important function, but their decision power is a weakness, and they find it very difficult to motivate large groups and engage people for changes. Of course, all these things don't matter. I mean, it's all fine. We can support them. So if a consultant is looking at, for example, decision power is a problem here, because this organization is using old-fashioned profiling. It doesn't work anymore. But its problem is that it cannot arrange consensus. It cannot get support of enough places where the organization is active over the globe so that it can really go for these new changes. So then you can start to think of communication supporting decision making and helping to enhance this kind of power of decision making and support, because really it isn't always that simply decided from above, but there are fractions within an organization. It's a whole. The bigger, the more policy environment actually it is. And it's very often needed to arrange decision-making and to gain support for it also from your employees, but also let them be part of the decision-making. Okay, so then there is another model that relates to this. This is Austrian Airlines. Have you seen it maybe before? They still use similar matters. And the slogan is like a smile in the sky. And, well, what does it say further on? Well, I think that it's basically enough, also looking at the time, to say that it's like a smile in the sky. So that means that their identity should also really be very friendly, because otherwise this doesn't sell. And basically that is behind the last model, where you have a change process and you should first do the change process and then, so first do the walk and then talk the talk. The current consultant chooses what fits the problem. I'm going to quickly go for this. And then we can end this meeting, but a question on my mind is, and you can also linger on a bit longer after class if you still want to talk with your neighbor and people from your group, are we now really ready? Because I'm not yet leaving, but some people will leave because it's end, but I will go back to this slide. Are you now ready for planning the interviewing, reporting? That there is also an flag to make individually, and there's no format or template for that. That's a free format to compensate that the other is quite fixed. So doesn't need to grill you when your English is not top-notch. Content is what I'm after. So do look at the student guide. If needed, you can email me. I'm saying all these matters today because on Thursday we have a festive activity that could also include some external guests, because that is my farewell lecture. It's relevant for your individual assignment because it's about this book on turbulence, but I will not then talk about your assignment, your homework and things. So that's why I'd rather take your questions after this class. And for this class, so today's class gained a lot of insight, hopefully in strategies, brings you one step further with the course work, and next time we have this special open speech, and I hope there will be many of you present, and it's a shorter lecture, but I hope you will enjoy it a lot and that it helps your work too. Thank you for your attention.